Right, if I could have everyone's attention here, please. I'm Jim Copeland, and I'm the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. So I'd like to welcome you all here to our evening forum tonight. Before I give a very brief remarks of introduction and introducing our speakers, I'd like to ask everyone, please turn off your cell phones or beepers. I've been informed that even if they're silenced, it could interfere with these wireless mics we've got. So it's preferable if you can actually turn them off. I'm going to briefly introduce the folks here. They're going to each speak briefly. We're going to have some discussion amongst ourselves, and then we're going to open for audience questions. We'll end tonight around 7:30. There'll be time, if you don't get to ask your question, to discuss in a reception afterwards, which will go till 8 o'clock. Do realize that there are books for sale in the back of the room. Each of our distinguished financial journalists here has authored a book on the recent financial crisis. I'd recommend all three of them to you. And so, of course, you can get a book after the event. We've scheduled this, the Manhattan Institute, The Economist magazine, scheduled this event on September 14th. Tomorrow marks the two-year anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers Investment Bank, which precipitated the financial crisis that has left us in the United States in our deepest recession in almost 30 years. And really, this is the first time in the living memory of most of us in this room, probably all of us in this room in terms of the active living memory, where we've had a recession on this scale precipitated by a financial collapse. The last, of course, being the Great Depression, which was precipitated by the stock market crash of the late 20s and the subsequent banking collapse that followed. Now, those of us who are students of economic history realize that financial collapses are far from unique. As rare as they've been for us, as early as 1792, we had a financial crisis in the U.S., and the first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, moved aggressively to intervene in that crisis, and we subsequently had about six more financial crises over the next 100 years or so, some of which, including that of 1873, led to significant long-term economic downturns. After the 1907 crisis, the disaster was really averted by the aggressive work of financier J.P. Morgan, the government responded with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. And after that effort failed with the Great Depression, we of course got the panoply of regulatory agencies that were and regulations that were set up in the Glass-Steagall Act and the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. So what we really want to talk about today is looking back 2 years after the fact, what precipitated this event? How can we learn from it? What should we do to prevent or to minimize the risks of these events going forward? And how does the recent congressional legislation, which has just passed, the Dodd-Frank bill, get it right, and how does it get it wrong? What should we be worried about, and what should we be trying to fix going forward? To answer these questions, we've got three of the foremost financial journalists in the country. First, to my immediate left, someone who hails from outside the country, the U.S. business editor and the New York bureau chief for the Economist magazine, Matthew Bishop, who co-wrote with Michael Green the book, the title of the book, the specific title was The Road from Ruin, How to Renew Capitalism and Put America Back on Top. An excellent book, and it really takes the long view for financial crises, going all the way back to what many of us regard as the first great financial crisis of modern capitalism, the tulip mania in Holland in the early 1600s that was really an offshoot of the development of the first futures market. Next, my colleague, Nicole Gelinas, who's the Searle Freedom Trust Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor at our City Journal. Nicole is a chartered financial analyst. She previously covered financial topics for Thomson Financial here in New York, has written a lot for the New York Post, and her new book that was released last year is called After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington. And Nicole looks specifically at the U.S. evolution, the evolution of the U.S. financial markets from the Great Depression, when we set up this regulatory structure, through to the recent crisis, particularly looking at the evolution from 1980 forward, and the government's aggressive intervention in a series of financial missteps, smaller crises, and tracks those through to the recent financial collapse with Lehman Brothers and the aftermath. And then finally, we're pleased to have the distinguished journalist Roger Lowenstein with us, a longtime reporter for the Wall Street Journal, used to author its Heard on the Street column. Roger has written numerous books, including his most recent on this topic called The End of Wall Street, which looks very carefully at the development of the mortgage industry that precipitated the recent collapse. And his recent books also are all around this topic, including When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, which Nicole discusses in her book extensively as well. Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, looking at the dot-com bubble's crash, and his co-authored book that same year, 2004, Crashes, Booms, Panics, and Government Regulation. So we're very lucky to have each of these folks with us. We're going to start actually over on the left with Roger and then move back to Matthew with comments before we'll engage in some discussion. So let's give our panelists a warm welcome.
Jim, thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. I think it's a testimony, the crowd here, not only to the Manhattan Institute and the fabulous co-panelists that I have, but to the searing episodes that we all lived through in 2008. I don't have a firsthand memory of the tulip bubble, but I do remember the moment you discussed, September 14th, 2008. My editor had been trying to get me to write about what had been referred to earlier that year as the subprime crisis, and then the mortgage crisis, and then the financial crisis. And I'd continuously been telling her, I don't think there's enough. Nobody really cares about Bear Stearns. OK, maybe Fannie, maybe Freddie. And so this week, Lehman goes under. AIG is rescued by the Federal Reserve. The money market industry is rescued. Paulson goes to the White House to ask for legislation to, you know, partly socialize the banking system. And my editor calls and says, do you think maybe now you have, you know, enough to start tackling this? There's been so much discussion around the topic of Dodd-Frank and the legislation, particularly with regard to how do we stop bailouts, how do we stop too big to fail, that I want to use a part of my 7 minutes, and they're precious, to divert you away from that subject. Because the reason we're here tonight and the problem we had isn't that there were government bailouts or that some institutions were judged to be, rightly or wrongly, too big to fail. That was the remedy. Maybe some of the remedies were appropriate, maybe they weren't. The reason we're here is we had a terrible financial crisis, and unlike many of the others that preceded it in the last 20 years or so, Jim ticked off some of them, one that bled into the larger economy, you know, 9.6% unemployed now, and an economy that is bank assets are falling, credit card assets are falling, we're still not really out of it. The problem wasn't the bailouts, it's the crisis. And the main point I want to make in the rest of my precious 7 minutes is that essentially this was a private market problem. Yes, Fannie and Freddie were culpable in many ways. Yes, the government enabled them. But basically what we had here was a system of, was a classic bubble. And the instrument of the bubble was mortgage finance. And we went from a system where banks would give you 30-year fixed mortgages to saying, we can lower the rate a little bit if it's an adjustable rate, to saying, well, we can lower the rate even more if the initial rate, if you don't pay us any of the interest principal back in the beginning, just the interest. And then how would you like that? Not even pay all of the interest in the beginning. We can give you a really cheap rate. And then for some of you who still feel left out and can't afford it, maybe the old 80% of the value of their home isn't enough. Maybe you want 90, 95% or 100. And then for the few souls out there who still couldn't cut it, you know, if you really take umbrage at having to document the fact that you have any income at all, well, we can do business with you too. We can give you a no-doc loan. And these instruments were all financed by means or refinanced of a complex chain that went from the corner bank to Wall Street to investors around the world, backed by instruments that were increasingly esoteric and virtually impossible for the investor to relate to the underlying asset back there, whether it was 1,000 mortgages in San Bernardino or whatever it was. And we've actually seen the same evolution in assets, all sorts of assets that become financialized as deregulation has occurred in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. More and more of the decisions in society, the economic decisions, have been left to markets, not to regulators, not to fixed prices, and so on. And so more and more assets have been subject to speculative and sometimes a highly speculative excess and to its sure corollary, reversal and panic. And I think, you know, in essence, that's what we suffered. And this all, these incidents, not just the one in 2008, but the long-term capital, all the others, Black Monday and so on, grew up under the shade of a dubiously protective theology, which was virtually any new instrument, any idea that the private market comes up with must be good because people in the private market are out to maximize their own income, and bankers would never do anything so foolish as to jeopardize their own institutions. Well, we've seen otherwise. I'll stop. Yeah.
Nicole?
Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Jim. Without minimizing any of these reasons for the crisis that Roger laid out, I would argue that the bailouts were at least as much a cause of the crisis as they were a remedy. And I'll get back to that in a minute. First, I wanted to say that September 14th, 2008 was important to me too, and that was the day that I got married, and I was I was waiting for the financial system to collapse, and unfortunately I had other things to do that day, so I had to be away from it for at least a few hours on that day. So the Dodd-Frank bill, now a law since the president signed it I guess about 6 weeks ago. The official title of this law is the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. And it should really be called the Recovery Prevention Act of 2010 and beyond. And this is the problem with the debate over financial regulation, that it hasn't been gotten across to politicians of either party that this bill matters, or law matters, for job creation now. It's retarding the recovery, it's affecting the nation's standing in the world. And it's also, as horrible as it may sound, it's affecting the president's chances at re-election. And why is that? What's in the bill? What's immediately apparent is that there are many new acronyms, at least 9 new acronyms we're getting. Now, it would be, if the only result of the bill is that you have more acronyms, more bureaucracy, more demand for Washington office space, that would not be so bad. I mean, businesses are used to dealing with rules and regulations, and jumping through hoops gives us something to complain about. The problem with the law is that it actually continues what we've been doing wrong with the financial industry going on a quarter of a century now. And some of these missteps we've taken in the financial industry, really not missteps, but more unseen public policy toward the financial industry, this is what got us into this mess in the first place. And in the government's attitude toward the financial industry and toward housing through finance, in some ways, President Obama is not our first state capitalist president. He's really our fifth state capitalist president. For a quarter of a century, Washington has been implicitly subsidizing the financial industry and distorting the rest of the economy through these measures. Effectively, Washington has been allocating capital and production, sometimes the lack of production, through arbitrary and non-free market treatment of the financial industry. And how is that? Since 1984, when a bank called Continental Illinois out of Chicago failed or was going to fail, this was at the time the eighth largest bank in the country, Reagan administration stepped in and said something that was new, that none of the bondholders to this institution would take any losses. So this effectively began a new policy. You know, the government tried off and on to do something about this for the next decade, never really succeeded. After the Continental Illinois bailout, if you were a bondholder to a large bank, you could kind of understand that when you lent money to this institution, you would be protected in a crisis. Now, this was not an ironclad rule. Nothing ever is, but it was a reasonable expectation on the part of bondholders who are supposed to be taking risk that this was a good deal for them. You know, you lend to a Citigroup or another large bank, you get a higher return than you get than lending to the government, but you've got government protection during a crisis, which is when you're going to need it. Over the years, this policy grew. Eventually, you know, as Roger wrote in When Genius Failed, not even a hedge fund could fail through normal bankruptcy processes. Its lenders got special treatment that was marshaled by the Federal Reserve. A decade before long-term capital management, back in 1990, Drexel could fail through normal bankruptcy. Lenders take orderly losses. Nearly a decade later, that could no longer happen. And so effectively, parts of the financial industry became a protected class, and this distorted the rest of the financial industry and the economy as well. What was the result of this on the economy and also on the social fabric? Well, if you want to create a crisis that is caused by too much consumer debt and too much financial industry debt, the best way to do that is to subsidize financial industry debt and consumer debt through these implicit guarantees of future rescues. And that's exactly what we did. This is not the whole story, but this is a part of the story that complements what Roger has said as well. And some of the numbers show the extraordinary growth of finance since the government started protecting finance as a special class. Back in 1984, financial industry debt as a percentage of gross domestic product, about 25%. By 2008, it was more than 100%. What did financial industry do with all of that debt that it borrowed? It basically turned around and lent a lot of this money back to consumers through all of the various exotic permeations of finance that we've seen. In 84, consumer debt, maybe 50% of GDP. By 2008, getting towards 100% of GDP as well. And so what did this do leading up to 2008? Well, it's distorted capital allocation into the economy. If you are a factory worker, you work at a firm that's purchased by a buyout firm that benefits from cheap financing provided by a Citigroup, you're not really a victim of free markets. You're a victim of government distortion of free markets. If you've overinvested in your house, you haven't put money in global equity markets, you're not a victim of free markets. You're a victim of this government distortion of the marketplace. And all of the jobs that weren't created in other parts of the economy besides housing and finance, these jobs that weren't created are also victims, not of the free markets, but of government protection of one part of the economy at the expense of the others. What happened in 2008? Not so much the beginning of a financial cataclysm caused by the collapse of Lehman, but really a hint that free markets were not happy with this system. What happened in September 2008 and the months before it and after it, really continuing through now, is that the free markets kind of won at least a battle, if not the war. They exposed this system for what it was, that it could not stand on its own without massive government intervention and support. Difference was the intervention came out into the open, not so much hidden. And so what does the law do to prevent the same thing from happening again and happening right now? Unfortunately, not very much. We've seen that one of the biggest problems with the financial sector is it has been competing with the rest of the economy with an unfair advantage rather than supporting the rest of the economy. That is continuing. In the Dodd-Frank law, you've got provisions to do everything that we did in 2008. Just on it's institutionalized, so now it is in the law that we can do these extraordinary bailouts. For example, part of the 2008 government actions was to allow large financial institutions, bank holding companies, to borrow debt that was explicitly guaranteed by the FDIC so that they could refinance their old debt that wasn't guaranteed. There's now a fast track process to do that in the future. So this idea of these firms being able to borrow with government protection has now been institutionalized well beyond, you know, normal deposits insurance. Same thing with some of the other problems that Roger talked about. One of the reasons that we got into this mess was no limits on borrowing for some financial instruments. The only thing that was exotic about exotic derivatives was that the old Depression era constraints on borrowing did not apply to them. And very disparate limits on borrowing in other parts of the economy. Effectively, the government said, you can borrow very heavily against a mortgage investment because it's perfectly safe. You can't borrow so heavily against a corporate loan because it's not safe. So you had everyone making the same mistake in the economy. System could not withstand that. What we needed in the bill was a way for these firms to be able to go bankrupt through the normal market processes, just as they did until the modern era. You do that by applying uniform borrowing limits on them so that a firm can go bankrupt without leaving so much unpaid debt behind it that it takes the rest of the economy with it. And the same type of limits on derivative securities, so derivative instruments, and trading rules for these instruments so that marketplaces, regulators can know, is there a firm out there that has taken $500 billion worth of exposure on something that they cannot pay back? When that's the case, a bailout is inevitable. So those are things that we should have done. The bad news, of course, is that we did not do them. And I would say that it would be good in this case if the political process worked, if even belatedly, rather than have the markets work. Because what will happen is if markets can't discipline financial firms, by disciplining the financial firms themselves, putting them through consistent, predictable system of bankruptcy, what will happen is they'll end up disciplining them through disciplining the government that these firms are protected by. And when that happens, it will be more difficult for the U.S. government to borrow, and borrow for purposes that it should be borrowing for, too, infrastructure and so forth. And with that, I will wrap up. Thanks, Jim.
In 2002, I wrote an article as one of those special reports for The Economist called Capitalism and Its Troubles, which was reflecting on the problems that capitalism had back then, in those happy days when everything was going so well. And one of the things that it looked at, one of the things I ended up writing, was that the banking system had this capacity to melt down spectacularly, and if we didn't look at that issue very hard, we could have trouble ahead. Now, I, at the time, interviewed Alan Greenspan about this. I think it was about the most terrifying interview I've ever done, because at that moment he was still, I think, regarded as a god. It was like being ushered into this, he sat in this big leather chair. I had to perch on the end of a chaise long in the Fed very uncomfortably and ask him these questions. And it was—it really was he was the most intimidating, formidable intellect of the time, and he was absolutely convinced that maybe there was a possibility that markets could have a bit of irrational exuberance, but fundamentally, he didn't really believe they could get wildly out of whack, because he believed that the people in the market knew what they were doing, and he also was convinced that the Federal Reserve, the price it would have to pay to actually stop a bubble forming was very high in terms of having to force the economy into recession. And on the other hand, the Fed would be capable of quickly restoring growth in the event that a bubble did burst. And so he wasn't troubled at all by some of the analysis that I was talking about. And to be honest, when September the 15th happened, I was as surprised as anyone else. So I'm not claiming here to have had been someone that predicted this. The reason Michael Green, who's there on the front row, and I wrote this book was that we were shaken to the core by a challenge to, I think, a lot of our worldview about how capitalism worked and what sort of failure was possible in capitalism, when not only Lehman Brothers failed, but it seemed like the entire global financial system would have to be bailed out by the government. This was not how it was supposed to be. But I open with this story because You know, it seems to me that at the heart of this crisis is an intellectual failure. The great intellects like Alan Greenspan really did get it wrong. And it's an intellectual failure both about the role of markets and about how government works and its role and capacities in the economy. And the reason, again, we wrote the book is that we wanted to promote a debate fundamentally about how do we fix both those sides of the coin. And my first thing I want to say is I'm very struck by how little of that debate has been seriously engaged in. that what we have is the sort of classic post-bubble sort of blame and denial exercise, and very little hard thinking has been going on, in my view. I mean, the second point, you know, the first half of the book is really a backwards look, as Jim said, at every major sort of bubble and crash that we could find that we thought was interesting, and it's just so clear how this is in the nature of capitalism, that and that at the heart of this process of bubbles and crashes is innovation, and how we as a society react to innovations that are fundamentally good, and how we seem to have this habit of becoming over-optimistic because we don't really know how to properly use the innovations and value the innovations. And then, you know, something finally we all realize we're running off the edge of the cliff and there's no ground underneath and we panic. And a lot of the history of whether these crashes result in, you know, long-term problems economically or not depends on how we respond to what's happened through the policy responses that are made. And when fundamentally the policy responses are about embracing that innovation but learning from what went wrong and actually learning how to use the innovation, you know, recovery tends to happen relatively quickly. When we try and suppress the innovation and say this was a terrible mistake, it wasn't a great thing after all, things tend to go take a lot longer to get better. And I feel in a lot of the conversation that's been going on as part of this process of the last couple of years has been this sort of, whoa, you know, all this innovation was terrible. And a lot of the regulatory response is not designed to tap into the financial revolution of the last 25 or 30 years. It's designed to slow it down, the Basel thing of just sort of saying, well, let's, you know, we don't know how much capital is safe, but let's at least make people have more of it in the hope that they won't take so many risks, or if they do, there's more of a cushion, or so many of the other things that are out there. So there's been this, I mean, fundamentally, it's like when the first car crash happened. The law was passed where someone had to walk in front of a car with a red flag and just say, help, you know, watch out, there's a terrible thing coming and we're going to make sure it drives very slowly, rather than what we eventually did was we figured out you could improve brakes, fit a horn, teach people to steer properly and that kind of thing, which should be the response now. The other thing I really, the second half of the book is an agenda, what we think ought to be done to really create a modern capitalism for the 21st century, and how we feel the state ought to change, how we feel the markets ought to change. And I really want to pick up on Nicole's point, this idea of Ronald Reagan state capitalist, which I just find just so shocking as I try and rethink my history of the last 30 years and how that state capitalist brought down the Soviet Union and so forth and changed China forever and all those sorts of things. It just doesn't ring true to me, and I think what's been noticeable to me in the debate has been how people have talked about capitalism, they've talked about the state as things that are kind of out there and separate from us and somehow separate from each other. And I mean, the reality is in this day and age, in a country like America, we are living in a democracy. Most of the capital in the capital markets belongs to the same people who are voting through their retirement savings. These things are not, you know, they're the same people in charge of both systems. And what we have at the moment, it seems to me, is a crisis of society in terms of the institutions of society have somehow become divorced, whether they're in the market or in the state, from the interests of the people whose money and votes are being exercised. And fundamentally, I mean, I go back to Mrs. Thatcher, my other favourite state capitalist, who was trying to create this thing called popular capitalism, where, you know, privatising things, encouraging share ownership. It never really got as far as it could have done in Britain. But, you know, at the end of the day, what we have to do now is not try and sort of conjure up some sort of historic, anarchic sort of Randian vision of what capitalism should be like. But we actually have to say our institutions of the market are failing, our institutions of government are failing, and we need to figure out how we solve that problem. And partly it's going to be the fault is in ourselves, that we are, as citizens, perhaps not really living up to, we're not being as well equipped to actually handle the challenges of managing our own money and managing our own government as well as we ought to do. And this ought to be how we actually create a competent citizen. We ought to be pretty high up the list of challenges that we face. But, you know, our pension funds and our mutual funds are, you know, completely failing in my view, in their fiduciary responsibility to us to actually invest with a long-term view to our retirement and to actually engage in corporate governance and to actually, you know, make sure that boards that year after year, like Lehman Brothers board, are rated D by people that have looked at it because they're sort of an actress and a vicar or whatever else on the board. I mean, at some level, this issue should be taken seriously. And likewise, you know, I think the regulators clearly had a lot of powers they didn't use. Well-functioning markets require good regulators. We need to have a debate that's sensible, that says regulation isn't just a terrible thing. It can be a terrible thing, but isn't necessarily a terrible thing. And actually, we need regulation that works. And so, I mean, the book is really a cri de coeur for let's actually engage with the big issues. Let's really figure out how do we create a modern set of institutions. I mean, as a Brit, and my fellow co-author is a Brit as well, we worry a lot that America is in danger of coping with its loss of relative dominance in the world economy by following the British route of denialism, and rather than actually saying let's really sort ourselves out and help actually manage a world where China and others are coming up and being equal partners and so forth, and seeing that as a good thing. We worry that America, I mean, I'm just shocked by how many conversations I have with really successful, influential American people who are fundamentally depressed about America and wish we were China. I mean, because China doesn't have to deal with wishes of the people, it can just get on and fix the problems. I mean, that to me is just like not an American attitude. I mean, if it was coming from Britain, I could kind of understand it, you know, certainly. But now from America, this is like ridiculous. Let's not have this denialism and call Reagan a state capitalist. Let's actually fix our institutions in this country, and the world will look to America again as the great model on the great city on a hill that we all in the rest of the world need it to be. So that's my my rant.
All right.
First, I'm going to turn it back to Nicole. Reagan as state capitalist. Matthew, take some issue with that. Do you want to rehabilitate that a little bit?
No. With regards to too big to fail financial firms, a policy of treating the bondholders and other creditors to these firms differently than you would treat similarly situated bondholders and creditors in any other sector of the economy, we can debate what to call it, but it is not free market capitalism. And the same thing with instruments that are so complex that they cannot be unwound in a bankruptcy court. That may look like free markets, but it's not free markets because it keeps these companies, it insulates them from market discipline, because the lenders to these companies know that they will not go through consistent, predictable bankruptcy process, that it will be a political process, and it has more to do with how much they can convince the government that failure of these firms will bring down the rest of the economy. And that is an untenable situation for the country to treat the financial sector, you know, certain parts of the financial sector, as national champion industry. That is no different than a country saying it's going to support steel production or you name it. It's even worse because it's hard for people to understand. And this is the industry that allocates capital to all other industries. I mean, when you're angry that the chief of Goldman Sachs is making tremendous bonus and you're at home and your little store is closing, you're not really mad at free market capitalism. You're mad at a system that treats bondholders to these firms differently than bondholders to firms in any other part of the economy. And that's very important. And I think people actually understand that intuitively. When we've seen voters so angry over the past couple of years, they're not really angry at capitalism. They're the only ones sticking up for capitalism. It is Washington and parts of the financial industry and Wall Street that have not wanted to adhere to the rules of capitalism when it's hurting them acutely.
Roger, Nicole was pretty critical of the Dodd-Frank bill, I think it's safe to say. And Matthew sort of tried to frame sort of where he thought we ought to be talking about going forward. You didn't get into that much in your introductory remarks. Do you want to talk about your reaction to Dodd-Frank and going forward?
I can give Dodd-Frank and the other measures I've been taking two cheers. But first I want to pick up on something that Nicole has mentioned, which is the special treatment given to finance when it's really just like steel and so on. I'm going to disagree with that. Finance is different. If you have one steel mill close, they don't necessarily all close. And if they do all close, it doesn't necessarily spread to nickel and molybdenum and computers and shipping. Finance is different. In finance, we have panics. And when the panics spread, they really can take the economy down, as they did in the 1930s and as they have now. That's the reason, by the way, that too big to fail is a lot easier, or to say, you know, we're not for bailouts and everything, is a lot easier to say in drawing rooms than it is in practice. Ask Hank Paulson. I mean, let's remember what happened on September 14th, and I think we shouldn't romanticize the so-called predictable process of court bankruptcy that Nicole has talked about. Lehman went through a predictable court bankruptcy. Hank Paulson was a patriot, right, a patriot for free market capitalism, no bailout. And within 36 hours, the world was spinning off its axis. And they finally said no mas, you know, in effect, and started with the bailouts. So we here in salons can talk about perfect capitalism. When you're looking at hundreds of thousands of people in these firms being thrown out of work and grinding the whole economy down, finance is different. I think I said I could give Dodd-Frank two cheers. I think the instruments that are failing now are different and more innovative. But the reasons we have financial panics ain't that different than in the tulip era in 1792. Too much leverage, too much risk in the form of leverage. In fact, it's interesting that if you look at the dot-com bubble of 2000 and, you know, the late 90s, when that thing fell apart, nothing much really happened except, you know, some kids with websites had to go back to honest work. But because that was an equity bubble but was not based on a lot of borrowing, there was no big aftershock or depression. And I think the Dodd-Frank bill, by taking, we have one class of risk in this economy called derivatives, which is grew up outside the framework of the traditional 1934 Act regulation. And Dodd-Frank basically said, no, derivative risk, SIVs, those all SIVs go back on the balance sheet. Derivatives, we're going to see what you do. They're going to go through clearinghouses. Clearinghouses are going to set capital limits. Obviously, they're insanely complicated, and we're going to see how it works in practice. But I think it makes a good start in saying those two now will be subject to risk limits. And what's happening in Basel, I think, is terrific. Basically, in Basel, they're saying, when do banks get in trouble? We know when they get in trouble. They get in trouble when they have too many assets for the amount of capital. And so from now on, they're going to have more capital. I don't expect perfection from regulators either. We shouldn't. But for imperfect people who happen to be regulators, that ain't a bad place to start.
So Matthew, you were critical of Basel. Roger was just praising it. Do you want to react to that? And also, I'm interested in your take. Roger's suggesting that the bailout here, or the intervention on the part of the federal government was necessary. Following from the crisis, there's been a lot of...
I think this was understandable.
Understandable, yeah. Understandable. Yeah. And that the Financial Inquiry Commission has been looking at this TARP. How would you rate the reaction of the Treasury Department and the Fed in the short run? And then how would you discuss Basel and react a little more strongly to the specific changes that have been going on that Roger talked about, and including Dodd-Frank?
Well, I mean, I think that anyone that's studied history of finance knows that Hank Paulson's decision to let Lehman fail was a catastrophically stupid decision that inevitably led to the kind of meltdown that we saw over the next few years, over the next few days, that forced him to immediately turn tail and become a state capitalist or socialist or whatever you want to call him. This is a man who was made physically sick by the thought of nationalisation, who ended up nationalising. I mean, I find, but history is just so clear that if you let the financial system go down, it makes whatever economic situation you're in, even if we're probably heading for a mild recession, it turns it into a very, very deep recession. I mean, the Rogoff book, which has been selling so well, has 800 banking crises around the world, and they all result in very, very deep recessions. And so he should have known that letting Lehman fail would have this effect because it was so connected to everyone else, and it was a disorderly bankruptcy. It's shocking to me, and I can only assume that having bailed out Fannie and Freddie, presumably to stop upsetting the Chinese, he got so many hostile calls in Congress from Republican people who thought that the election would be lost if he didn't go and lay down the law to Wall Street, that he felt he had to let Lehman Brothers fail for political reasons. Because it just seems to me you can't let banks of that critical importance fail in a disorderly fashion. Now, what Dodd-Frank has changed is it's removed the Paulson excuse that he didn't have the legal powers to do it, which I think was anyway not true. But nonetheless, clearly Lehman Brothers had a positive market value at the start of the weekend, and they could have justified bailing it out before the end of Sunday, just as they did with Bear Stearns earlier in the year. And it was sufficiently, if the markets thought it had a positive equity value, then no reason why the Federal Reserve shouldn't take that view. Going back to the 1720 in Britain, the South Sea bubble, the South Sea Company was bailed out by the British government. This is not exactly a new thing. It saw that it would be catastrophically bad for the City of London as a financial centre to let the South Sea bubble go down. So they bailed it out and threw a few people in jail and made some adjustments to the law, and London and Britain went merrily on its way for the next 150 years or whatever. I mean, the crisis is not the moment to get tough on too big to fail. It's before you get to the crisis. And I think a lot of the challenge that we need to be engaging with is how do we actually prevent ourselves getting into a situation where the whole system collapses like that, or is in danger of collapsing if the government doesn't intervene to save banks. And that is a much harder intellectual process than deciding whether to be tough or not at the last moment. And I'm not sure Basel, apparently Felix Salmon and I had an energetic tweeting debate on Sunday evening after the Basel Accords came out, and Felix pointed out that Lehman Brothers had 11% Tier 1 capital reserves as it went into that weekend where it failed. So the point about these capital standards is they reassure you that things are okay, but actually when the markets melt down in the way they did, you can have, unless you've got 100% capital or whatever, there's no guarantee that you're going to be safe. So it's sort of about how much capital you should have is sort of how long is a piece of string. I mean, it's basically very hard to actually really know whether you're making the system significantly safer or not. And anyway, we've had two previous efforts at Basel. Certainly Basel I made it, actually encouraged all sorts of risk taking around finessing the definitions of different sorts of risk-based assets. And so, and I think Basel II, had it ever been implemented, again, there were very precise definitions of this and that, which you can guarantee would have been the basis for clever financial engineering. If Basel III ever gets phased in, it's not coming in until 2015, to be phased in by 2023. Who knows what bank, you've given the banks 5 years to figure out the way around the rules anyway. As for most of the bulk of Dodd-Frank, clearly we don't know what most of it will amount to, because most of it is let's give the power to the regulators to figure it out. And so we're going into a period where you're going to have a lot of discretionary power exercised both by regulators and by the Federal Reserve. And you know, that's again why I think it's very important that the leaders of capitalism actually engage in these debates about how to regulate effectively, rather than and actually sort of have a public debate about this, rather than just sort of lobbying away behind the scenes and hoping for the best. Because I think we're going to get all sorts of interventions in the markets that are going to be based on, you know, the sort of arbitrary decisions of a small group of people in the whoever's in charge, in the, rather than based on proper debate and public consent.
One more question for Nicole then, and then I'll open up to the audience questions. So you've heard responses from both Roger and Matthew now. Is finance different? If in fact there was this big distortion created by these bailouts that were favoring the financial sector over the last 30 years, how would you explain the superior performance, for instance, of the S&P 500? If you bought stock in the S&P in 1950 and held it for 30 years, and then you bought stock in 1980 and held it for 30 years, notwithstanding the recent correction, you'd do about three times better if you bought that same stock in 1980 as if you bought it in 1950. So the counterargument would sort of be, yes, the financial sector grew, but that there was value created, that Wall Street was generating value, the creative destruction was happening that Schumpeter would have talked about. Resuscitate that theory a little bit, that the financial sector was over-invested in, mm-hmm. and then talk a little bit about, is it different? In other words, is it inherent that we're going to have some bailouts? And if not, how can we do it in an orderly fashion?
Right. Absolutely. Finance is different. We have learned and relearned this lesson many times over the decades. We relearned this lesson in the 1930s, and that's why we have deposit insurance, for example. It's a social and economic good that a person can save a few years' worth of money in the bank without having to have, you know, grandma look at the balance sheet of the bank to make sure it's in good condition. So that's one way in which finance is different and should be different. The same thing with the differences in how we treat financial firms so that they can be wound down in an orderly fashion for banks, go bankrupt for non-banks, without taking down the rest of the economy. And all of these things that we do, treating finance differently, are good ideas. Well, some of them. For example, capital rules on stock market, on other investments. You can lose all your money in the tech bubble if you want to, but because we have limits on borrowing in the stock market, you cannot lose so much money that you borrowed that you can't pay it back, and then you then bankrupt the bank. If you had 110% borrowing against stocks, the tech bubble would have bankrupted the financial system. We did not have borrowing limits in the housing market, and we did not have effective borrowing limits against the securities that all of these mortgages went into. So you do those things, you fix good deal of the problem. Same thing with derivatives. You've got to put cash down on old-fashioned derivatives markets. The only thing different about these new markets, well, I shouldn't say the only thing, but one of the things different about new derivatives markets is you could make tremendous promise to somebody to pay them tens of billions of dollars in some cases without putting any cash down behind that promise. So you really have infinite debt created into the economy that is fixed with limits on borrowing, and then you fix the problem of so much debt out there that the financial system can't possibly withstand the slightest change in assumptions without needing extraordinary government intervention. So finance is different, treated differently, should be treated differently, but that should not exempt the lenders to large financial firms from consistent market discipline. All lenders except for the small depositors, they're supposed to be lending to companies taking risk, being paid for that risk, doing the research of figuring out what the heck is this company doing with all of the money I've lent it, and right now they are not doing that. And as for the economy, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the economy has been very productive. You know, we've all got iPhones and so forth. We didn't have them 20 years ago. On the other hand, we have an enormous amount of debt that is still underpinning all of these assets, We've seen 2 years of consumers starting to pare back their debt. We don't know how long that's going to go on. We don't know what kind of effect that's going to have on the economy. And we also don't know what the government is going to do to make that process even harder. I mean, if you look at some Iceland, if you exempt creditors to some parts of the financial system from the threat of losses, eventually parts of the financial system will borrow so much money that the government can't bail them out anymore. And that's, I mean, it's a straight line up of debt to the financial industry. It's, you know, it is different, but if it gets to the point where it has consumed the government's ability to bail it out, it's going to be even different than it is different now. So, and yeah, I guess that answers both your questions.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. So I will open up the audience for questions. I'm going to call on J.P. Donlan right here first. Do we have microphones? So if you could just introduce yourself when I call on you.
Thank you, Jim. Before the session, Nicole, you and I had a conversation about your reading the Dodd-Frank bill, all 2,300 pages. And I said how long it took you, and you said several weeks. Well, I guess that's more than Nancy Pelosi put in. So what did you discover in actually having read it that might be salutary for the rest of us? For example, I came from a meeting with the CEO this afternoon who told me that he had met with Jamie Dimon, who told him, quote, "I have no effing idea," his words, "how this bill is going to affect our business." So that's kind of unsettling if the biggest financial institution has no clear idea of what's in store for us. So perhaps you can give us an idea, having read it.
Right. I think the big problems are the government is taking this philosophy that it can be omniscient, and that the problem was that we did not have a regulator to predict and prevent future crises before they happen. It's like that old show that only lasted a couple weeks on TV where the guy had the next day's paper on the day before, and so he would run around, you know, rescuing people before they fell off buildings. We've had the Federal Reserve, for example, in the late 80s, mid-80s really, Paul Volcker could see that junk bond issuance to purchase companies was causing a new risk to the financial system. And so he went ahead and convinced the Fed to vote to put the old margin requirements, the old limits on borrowing, onto these takeover bonds where you could not raise money to buy 100% of the company with debt. Did it make a big difference? I mean, arguably, the junk bonds bubble would have gone on even longer, and the crash would have been harder if you did not have these rules in place. The Fed could have, you know, if Greenspan had seen this, the risk that the mortgage financing industry posed to the economy, 2003, 2004, 2005, there's a lot he could have done. If he could not do those things with the powers that he had, he could have gone to Congress and asked for the power. He had such credibility and clout that he could have done that. In fact, in derivatives, he used his clout for the opposite reason, in saying, no, we don't need to regulate these things. So that is the biggest problem with the bill, is that it assumes that the new Financial Stability Oversight Council, the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, that they can kind of qualitatively go through all of this financial industry data and figure out how to prevent the next crisis. And that's just not going to happen. That's why we need consistent rules on borrowing, so that you can protect the economy from the results of the crisis that you don't see coming. And even, you know, to give an example, the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, this is the agency that Elizabeth Warren, Harvard Law School professor, might end up heading. She can be the most competent, far-sighted, smartest person in the world. She can't protect consumers against their biggest problem, which is too much debt. For as long as large financial firms can borrow with the expectation on the part of their bondholders that they'll get rescued in a crisis, too much debt is going to be feeding into the system. It will overwhelm any qualitative attempts to make sure that people know what they're getting into when they're borrowing money. I mean, most people, they knew that these mortgages were too much for them to shoulder. Well, they knew their credit card debt. You don't see a lot of regular people in Arizona surprised that their house isn't worth $2 million anymore.
I mean, to my mind, to equate the Consumer Protection Agency and the Financial Stability Council is a mistake, because I think, you know, I agree with you on the Financial Stability Council. I mean, the idea that any group chaired by the Treasury Secretary is going to actually act preemptively to stop a bubble happening, even if it had the knowledge to do that. I mean, politically, it's quite clear they, I mean, it's just, there's no way in the political cycle we have at the moment that any Treasury Secretary is going to try and take the bubble out of the economy. I think for the Consumer Protection Agency, I mean, it may be that they pursue a horribly interventionist agenda that suppresses innovation, but I think there is at least, you know, on the face of it to me, a real case. There is an agenda you could make for an agency that would say, well, there was a lot of information that was not made clear. No effort was made to really make sure the consumers understood what they were doing and whether they were taking on risks that they could manage. And I think you could. There is a lot that could be done to actually improve and require that people who are selling financial products to people who are not experienced in dealing with financial products, they actually know what they're doing and are properly educated. I mean, I think one of the things, if you look at the 401k revolution, I mean, I think it's absolutely sensible to try and shift retirement savings away from corporations to the individual and to be responsible for your own finances. But what we've seen is that many people are now managing their retirement incomes in a way that's going to mean they're going to be much worse off than they would be had they remained in a traditional defined benefit plan, because they don't have the expertise. They kind of run with the crowd. They sell at the bottom, buy at the top, all those sorts of things. And I think, had we actually accompanied that policy shift with a real effort on, properly making sure that people understood what they were doing and were educated in finance, then we might actually be able to look at a popular capitalism based around, being responsible for your own retirement incomes that actually was working. And it's quite clearly not working very well at the moment. And I think that could be an agenda for the Consumer Protection Agency to get into. I can't say whether it will be or not, but it could be.
Right, I'm going to get another question from Manhattan Institute Chairman Paul Singer.
Thank you. A comment on the Lehman situation. My firm was and is one of the largest creditors of Lehman, and we sort of had a front row seat at the debacle. And the 11% Tier 1 capital is may be accurately measured by some fanciful measure of what the assets were, but upon bankruptcy, Lehman was more than 25 times leveraged. Moreover, because of its extreme opacity, as was true of every, and is true of every large financial institution in the world, traders in the derivatives books could not conceivably understand the actual financial condition of Lehman. It wasn't the bankruptcy. Lehman is comfortably in bankruptcy today. It's a few $100 billion case. It's going through the paces. The problem with Lehman and the thing that brought down the world was the sudden unwind of the derivatives book. It took dozens of billions of dollars of positive equity, and the derivatives books were not in bad shape. They were trading books. There was no big fraud in the trading books. It took that and erased something like $50 or $75 billion of value instantly. So it's not the bankruptcy process that's failed. It's that a change in the bankruptcy regime, having to do with the derivatives books, would be a very important fix, enabling large companies like Lehman and bigger to be comfortably unwound without the craziness of Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank, and just one comment on the Dodd-Frank, one of the worst things in Dodd-Frank is the provision that allows the government, the FDIC, to seize companies not that are in default, but that are in danger of default. This is absolutely new, it's unprecedented, never before seen in American insolvency law. And what's actually going to happen in the next crisis, because of that and another provision that enables the government to discriminate among creditors similarly situated, is the next crisis is going to be a black hole in which creditors and traders trading with large companies that are perceived to be in trouble going to step away, causing the very catastrophic collapse that the law was meant to prevent. So leverage limitations and some fixes to the bankruptcy law, far better than 2,700 pages that doesn't actually fix the too big to fail.
Any reaction to that?
Well, I agree that the leverage limits, I mean, the you know, leverage limits are part of the bill, and that the bill empowers the Fed and other regulators to set them, and along with Basel. I mean, that's, those are part of the 2,700 pages. They're rejoined to them. That's, that, I mean, to say that the, that not everything in the bill is good or optimal or even improves things, I would agree with that. But if the single biggest problem, I think I agree with what Singh was saying, the over-leverage of firms and the opacity of the leverage in the form of derivatives, I think the bill, and in particular Basel, will address. You know, it's not fine-tuned. One of us made the point that we're sort of shooting in the dark. How much cushion against leverage do we really need? No one knows. Well, that's true. I mean, these are human institutions, government-like banks. So Basel ratchets it up. It says, look, the limits we had weren't enough, and the amount of transparency we had in derivatives weren't enough, and now we're going to have more. So I think those are good steps.
But I think Paul kind of makes the point for me that in a way that, you know, Lehman having 11% Tier 1 capital as defined, and that bearing no relation to the reality of the bank, you know, is the problem with all these attempts at, you know, outside regulators defining capital and setting these capital cushions that appear to make things safe. You know, when fundamentally, you know, this means writing very complex definitions of what capital is that are, you know, almost inevitably going to be behind the curve because, you know, financial institutions, because they're profit motivated and, you know, not subject to public pay codes and so forth, are always going to be able to hire the best people. They're going to be able to, best lawyers, the best accountants, the best financial engineers. They're always going to be at least one step ahead of the regulators. They're going to be creating a more, it's a more opaque world. They're going to be finessing the rules. I mean, this is, we know this is going to happen. So I think these capital cushions, the Basel approach, always are going to be giving us a false sense of security, if they give us any sense of security at all. And that what we need to figure out is to get back to, you know, the great Greenspan era, which is that he assumed that banks would be capable of looking after their own self-interests, and figuring out how do we get these institutions, how do we make it easier for them to actually do that job properly. And I think a lot of, you know, if I was designing a systemic regulatory response, it would be focused on figuring out ways to provide better information to the market about where the risks are in the market. It would be much more around measurement and disclosure and transparency and providing information so that those players in the market could actually manage their risks properly, rather than thinking that as a regulator that, you know, you define capital in a way that's really going to affect behavior.
Any final thoughts, Nicole?
I would say that bankruptcy is a great way to provide information to the marketplace. And I'm not joking about that. I mean, I think AIG would have been better off in some ways in bankruptcy. And I completely understand why we had to do TARP, that this was not the time to do this, that this was the culmination of 25 years worth of bad decisions. It was not the beginning of them. But you've got a company that failed in managing its financing and its balance sheet, although it has profitable divisions, and it lives to see another day. And instead of having consistent market discipline, you have mob justice, where you've got a company that is still paying out these tremendous bonuses to people. The government can't touch the contracts, and that's right, they should not touch the contracts. The only way to unwind these contracts is through a bankruptcy process. So the same with Enron, the same with Lehman Brothers. It's better to have markets disciplining companies than to have people picketing in front of someone's house because he's being paid too much. The market will take care of that problem for you if you let it, through things like limiting leverage, requiring disclosure, all the rest, so that they can go bankrupt.
But will the market discipline leverage limits? Because all these firms that operated in the free market we're pretty highly leveraged.
Oh, no, we need government limits on leverage. Okay. I mean, just as we always have. I mean, okay. Not many people say that you should be able to borrow 100% on stock speculation, and you should not be able to, because that is not markets. That is just your avenue to a future bailout.
If I understand you right, you're saying, to some degree, you want consistent limits. In other words, we were treating housing differently than we were treating stocks, and we were treating derivatives, some types of derivatives, different than we were treating other types of derivatives, and this was part of the problem. And if I understand what Paul's saying correctly, I think what he's saying is we can use the bankruptcy process. We've just got to come up with a way to rebalance the derivative book of business with consistent rules so that you don't have the potential meltdown. This is what we witnessed when Lehman went down. So lots of interesting thoughts. We're going to have to cut this off to stay on schedule. Those of you with questions, I'm sorry we couldn't get all of you, but feel free to come talk to us and the panelists. We're going to have a reception until 8 o'clock, and you can get books back there in the back from each of these great gentlemen.
I think it is clear how fortunate we are to believe in the power of ideas.
Supply the common sense and the fresh thinking of the Manhattan Institute.